Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit. Bandwidth for Twitch is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
Hey everybody, I'm Ryan Schrout.
And I'm Patrick Norton. And this, of course, is Twitch. We got a year-end recap, some of our favorite segments, looking back at the year and what a year in hardware it was.
First up, this one is interesting. EVGA, known mostly for graphics cards, but they have also been in the motherboard business for some time, is making a gaming case. And it's not just a gaming case, guys. It is like an enormous gaming case. It has probably more space in it than anything I have seen. The design is incredibly interesting because they envision it being used where the window is facing you. So basically rotate the entire case 90 degrees on its base, right? You're not rotating any of the internal components. You're just making it so like the video cards are facing you. The window is facing you. Basically, you know, the idea, and it kind of makes sense if you think about it, is if you're going to spend this kind of money on this case, or you're going to spend this money on all the components inside and make it all pretty looking, that you should actually be able to enjoy the view when actually using the computer, which I think, you know, makes sense there. It's got, you know, clever little things here for, you know, hiding all the cables coming out of the back so that when you do have it rotated 90 degrees, it still looks clean and they don't have to do anything dramatic in terms of internal hardware. On the bottom, the power button is actually on the bottom right-hand corner of the window. Right. So you get an idea of kind of, again, how they're going to face it. And there's a fan controller there that in this version has like, you know, four main buttons. It's kind of a giant LED, you know, display in there just to give you the information. But they're actually going to, on the higher end model, offer a full touchscreen LCD down there that will do fan control. But it'll also let you monitor your GPU performance, your CPU performance, temperatures internally, anything that you could do through their EVGA precision software accessible through there. Lots of space for it, you know, cable grommets, cable routing. It's a really nice looking piece of hardware. And more interestingly is they're going to have multiple models, and they say targeting $79 on the low end and $299 on the high end, yet still maintain an all metal construction throughout all of those price ranges, whether that be two models or something else in between.
Interesting to say the least. If I needed a case and I was going to support four graphics cards and the hydro cooling that they're rolling in a system like that, you're going to need a case, something of that size to begin with.
Yeah.
I'll be curious to see though, if they do anything with like a micro ATX size design, where I don't need more than a single graphics card at this point. Or at least I don't want more than one. I'd rather spend extra on one really good one. But I do like the idea of hydro cooling things, and I'd like a little extra room for that. But man, that's a big case. It's just a giant system. So, but if you're rolling four GPUs and the cooling to do it all, you're going to need that kind of space. And the design looks fantastic. So
is the lack of, there are no optical bay capabilities on this case. Does that ruin it for you?
Not at all. I honestly, really? I have a couple external drives that I keep around just in case. My current workstation has a couple of Blu-ray drives in it just for that kind of work. But how often do I actually use them? Almost never anymore. And if I do, like I said, I have a couple of USB 2 or 3, either CD or DVD and Blu-ray drives just in case. Right. Kind of just moved them to external products anyway, because if I'm not using them in my desktop, and I don't think I'll ever buy another notebook again that has an integrated optical drive.
Agreed.
So it's one of those accessories that I find, sure, I might have a few of them still laying around, but do I actually use them very often? No.
Logitech G502 Proteus Spectrum, which is just a strange name even for a gaming mouse.
It is that for sure. Logitech has gone down a deep rabbit hole of naming their products just in the last couple of years or so.
I will say the weight system on this is fascinating. And I'm not trying to be snarky when I say that. They've actually done something really interesting.
Yeah, it's so the G502 as a product in and of itself has actually been around for a while, a year or so. The Proteus Core is what they call that one. This was the Proteus Spectrum, and in reality, the only change from last year's model to this year's model is the inclusion of an RGB LED system that you can control through the Logitech gaming software, that you can sync with your Logitech keyboard, your Logitech headset, so everything kind of has matching colors or matching patterns or whatever it is you wanted to do with it. It has fairly high-end specifications, you know, up to 12,000 DPI, up to 300 inches, greater than 300 inches per second on there, one megahertz reporting rate on USB, 32-bit ARM processor, you know, all that type of stuff that you're used to seeing in kind of higher-end mice. It's $79 for the RGB model. It's like $65 or so for the non-RGB model, which mm-hmm. I think will appeal to more people probably. The weight system is pretty simple, right? Like, there's a magnetic door on the bottom of the mouse, and it has spots to put up to 5 3.6-gram individual weights into the device, and you can thus, you know, adjust, try it without any weights in it, try it with all the weights, with anything in between, and obviously to your own preferences you can do what you want. I actually put all of the weights in there because it improves, you know, like when you're clicking the mouse, you're less likely to move the mouse while you're clicking it if it's a little bit heavier, those types of things. But some people who are into fast action games may want the lightness of removing all the weights. It's really just personal preference. But it's a good idea, right, that allows you to kind of experiment and see that. And it's not the first mouse to do that. We've seen mice do this years and years and years ago, but not a whole lot of them do it still today, which is, it's just a neat little addition there. It's got a nice braided cord. I think it feels really good. Mice are very much a like personal preference device, right? Much like keyboards can be, if what your tolerance for sound is, mouse comfort, right? It's definitely a right-handed mouse. It's not a left-handed mouse in any capacity. It's got enough buttons, but not an overabundance of buttons, which also is something I appreciate. I'm not accidentally hitting things on this mouse, which is a plus. You know, adjust DPI settings with a couple of buttons up there. You've got you got three thumb buttons, and then you've got your two standard. The wheel can be switched between free spinning and like the click spinning, which I can't find a good name for, which I'm a fan of. Like, I prefer almost all of the time the click wheel method, like where you get some traction in it, if you will, while you're turning it. But a lot of people like the free spin, and I use the free spin if I'm looking at very, very long documents or very long websites, for example. So the RGB stuff is neat, but I'm going to be honest with you, your hand covers the Logitech logo that has the RGB lights in it while you're using it. The only lights that are not covered while you're using it are, you can kind of see them there underneath my index finger. There's three outlets there for the DPI lights, DPI setting lights. And you can actually have those be enabled all of the time. So if you have a little bit of color there. And that's basically why you can see the light there on the logo. And if you scroll down the next picture, you should see the software where you can configure it. You can do breathing patterns, you know, color rotation, whatever, sync it up with other devices. The software works amazingly well. It's super simple to work around or work in. But because your hand kind of covers it, you only really get to see the full effect of the light when you're not using the mouse, you know, while you're typing or, you know, while it's just sitting there, right? So it makes a lot of sense for me to for people who aren't like OCD about color matching all of their devices on their desk or their chassis, you know, with everything else, that you spend $15 less and get the Proteus Core, because it is the same build quality, weighting system, cord, sensor, all that type of stuff. Yeah. So it's been the 502 Core has been our gaming PC mouse for a long time. They gave me a 502 Spectrum at CES, and I had just been looking for an excuse to really put that on my desk as my primary mouse, and I did, and that's good. There you go. That's always a nice a bonus for us here.
What's the story on the video of the Unreal Engine editor? Is somebody using? Oh, they are. It's crazy. They're building in VR with the Unreal Engine.
Yep. So they just announced this today. They're going to show it at GDC in March. The ability to build game engines or build game worlds in Unreal Engine using VR. I think in this case, they're using a Vive, HTC Vive device, and he's using two of the HTC Vive controllers. And if you watch the video, it's really cool, and it's like this very intuitive way to design things, right? Where it shows him like taking a pillar and rotating it, and then
I don't know if I'd call it. That looks really incredibly well practiced.
Like, you think so?
Yeah.
They posit in the video that like, hey, this is how your brain has worked since you were a baby, right? Like you're used to playing with blocks. You're used to moving things around on top of each other.
That part I get. That part I completely get. Like I want Jarvis dropping down the, you know, flathead motor schematics and them hovering in front of my face and me using my fingers to flick things open because, you know, I want to be Iron Man too. I'm just saying, like, I'm looking at this and how specific his motions and gestures are. And I'm wondering how long it took him. Like, it's amazing. Like, it's an amazing interface, but I'm really curious how long it took him to get this fast with everything.
Oh, I'm sure. Yeah, I'm sure it's practice. But like, if you look at the interface that he's looking through there, that's the standard Unreal Engine editor interface, right? You're just like, say, oh, you're looking at it on your virtual like iPad instead of a regular iPad, right? And you just like click on something and drag it out into the world. You scale it.
Seeing it in real time is crazy.
Yeah.
I mean,
now they don't address like how you move around in the world. Right. Like if you wanted to look at a different location and do editing, how you would do that. That's the same game design problem for it's interesting to see a separate application. Like this is what we knew would happen. Like there would be more applications or at least as many applications for virtual reality in the professional space as there would be in the actual gameplay space. And game design is one of those professional spaces, right? Where you're working in an environment that is completely different than what you've ever really worked in before and see how it changes up design aspects of things. I thought it was really cool. Had you ever played or gone through the Google built pixel art demo or like the art demo with the HTC Vive where you're drawing in 3D space? It's a very simplified version of what they're doing there, right? Where you can use the hand controllers to draw in real time. You bring up a context menu on your left hand and you pick out your brushes, your swatches, whatever it is, and you can like walk around your 3D structure while you're working on it and stuff like that. It's really, really cool.
Pretty crazy.
Yeah, and I have no artistic ability. That was never the intent, but it was super, super immersive, like immediately. Like I was like, oh wow. I can see how people that have more capability than I could do really, really cool stuff with this. And even me, I was having fun just playing around with it. And this is, I assume, a similar idea, but for people who are used to working in Unreal Engine on a 30-inch monitor or something like that. And I'd be curious to like talk with some of them and see what they think the changes actually are. So apparently it'll only be next month where they show this, you know, to the game developers in mass at the Game Developers Conference. I think it's in San Francisco this year. So we'll know more then. I'd like to get some hands on with it, even though I don't know anything about using the Unreal Editor. So maybe that's a bad idea, actually, in retrospect.
Well, maybe you'll learn a lot. Could be a new career.
Yeah. It turns out I'm really good at stacking blocks in virtual reality.
I got the Raspberry Pi 3 in. I was kind of amazed. I didn't realize until it showed up that it was 4 years from the original Raspberry Pi release, leap year, to in honor of the return of February 29th, they did the Raspberry Pi 3. And it's an interesting device, right? It's $35, I'm holding it right here. And hey, kids, it looks like a Raspberry Pi. And if you know, you look really, really closely and you have the right kind of eyes, you might notice that where some LEDs used to be right here is a little blocky antenna, and that's the Wi-Fi and Bluetooth antenna, because they finally incorporated Wi-Fi and Bluetooth on the board. They've got a fairly fast Broadcom chipset in there. It's 50% faster, give or take, than the Raspberry Pi 2. It is significantly faster than the Raspberry Pi 1. It's quad core, which is a nice addition. There's only 1 gigabyte of RAM, which a bunch of people, it was interesting to watch the responses because some people were like, yes, Wi-Fi is on board. Bluetooth is on board. Awesome. And then there were a lot of people who were like, I can't believe you haven't put a SATA adapter I can't believe you haven't put more than 1 gigabyte of RAM on it. I can't believe, and this actually one is probably a pretty legitimate complaint, because essentially the USB and the Ethernet share a single USB input, for lack of a more appropriate term, on the processor. That's been a complaint. So if you want to sort of read and write things from a USB drive through the Ethernet port, you run into traffic issues. Not that you run into a lot of traffic issues with a processor of this size, but it was funny because Element 14 did a bunch of benchmarks of the of it, and then they did some benchmarks. They looked around to look at the sort of raw, like, you know, Whetstone type stuff, and performance wise it is in the neighborhood of a K7 or a Pentium 3. So the $35 PC is now up to you know, 99-2000 desktop PC performance,
right,
with I suppose, if you think about it, slightly less RAM. But on the flip side, when you look at these, whether you're talking about this or, you know, I've got a chip PC over here, you know, as little standalone devices, as centers for appliances, as little tiny Linux servers, they're getting fairly powerful, which is pretty cool. I actually use this as a desktop to show off the web pages we were using on Tech Thing this week. And it was doing pretty well. Then it crashed. You know, it's got a version of Minecraft running on it. I actually had Minecraft and a browser running at the same time, which if you've ever tried to run the Raspberry Pi 2 as a desktop machine, you understand why I was kind of fascinated by that. But 8 million Raspberry Pis are out in the wild now, and it has a huge collection of projects and ideas. But it looks like a good part. Doesn't solve if you were frustrated with the sort of USB Ethernet combined combination. It doesn't solve that. It doesn't add SATA. It doesn't add USB 3.0. It doesn't add gigabit Ethernet, but it is considerably faster than the Raspberry Pi 2. And again, it's got Mai Tai
would be good.
Mai Tai on board. Wi-Fi and Bluetooth 4.1 and low energy on board. So it's good stuff. Oh, and the GPIO pins are still exactly the same, and it uses, you know, all of the applications or all of the distros that have been made for the Raspberry Pi, you know, Model 2, right. Model 1 will work with this, which is, I think, very, very smart on their part. And it is a 64-bit part, but they are still running a 32-bit operating system, and the Raspberry Pi organization says they will be experimenting and testing to see if they get any advantage out of a 64-bit version of the operating system. I know people who have replaced the vast majority of their desktop PC or laptop usage with an iPad or an Android tablet. I think it really depends on what you're doing and how well the Android or iOS applications have been created. I think for a lot of people who don't spend the majority of their day in a single application, it can be frustrating, even with the new pro versions of the operating system, to deal with multiple applications simultaneously. If you spend 90% of your day inside of a drawing app, if you spend 90% of your day doing email and you have the keyboard, if you spend 90% of your day in a particular form-based system, that allows you to interact with, you know, if you spend the majority of your time, you know, in one app or one or two apps, I think it works really well. For, you know, we're also on the content creation edge of the bell curve, right? Or at the far end of the bell curve is my friend's dad who owns a computer because he plays checkers. And in the middle of the bell curve is, you know, everybody who's like, well, you know, I've got Facebook and I've got the internet. I do my tax software and occasionally I do the photos for the kids or I do the photos for my parents. And, you know, I edited a video last week. That was really cool. But we're all the way on the far right of the bell curve where it's like, you know, I'm editing a web page. I'm editing a video. I'm encoding a video. I'm encoding two videos. I'm editing another web page. I'm turning around and I'm, you know, compiling something so I can run it on this thing over here. So
right.
For people who programmers, developers, content creators, heavy gamers, all that stuff, they're not going to replace their desktop PC, you know, with an iOS or an Android-based tablet. But, you know, but there's kind of a sweet spot where you're spending a lot of time in applications that work particularly well on iOS that could be really, really compelling. It's a fast processor. I'm really curious to get some hands-on time with that 9.7-inch screen because it sounds utterly fantastic. but it is a professional tool, and it is priced professionally.
Yep.
To say the very least about
that.
Fair
enough.
I bring to you, ladies and gentlemen, from the makers of Barbie, from the makers of Hot Wheels, from the makers of the awesome way to burn your fingers, Thing Maker, which, if you are old enough, you remember was a metal mold, basically a hot plate where you can mold things, and then later on a hot plate in a box so you can mold things without burning your fingers or setting the house on fire. Coming fall 2016, the ultimate 3D printer for creative families, the Thing Maker, which is essentially a Mattel 3D printer, and including an actual app that they worked with. The Thing Maker, the Thing Maker design app, which is, you can download it right now on iOS or Android. It is extremely early in the app design, but they got together with
MakerBot, Autodesk.
Thank you.
There you go.
Sitting there, I'm like, I drove by the Autodesk building like every day of my life for several years. And Autodesk is doing some amazing stuff to bring 3D modeling tools and make them more accessible. I'll be really curious to see how this turns out, and what they, because right now you look at the model, there's some sort of robots you can play with, and a necklace design and some other stuff. But the idea is that you're going to be able to assemble figures, accessories, dragging and dropping parts together. So it is a really interesting, really interesting premise. Yeah, $300 is the price. It looks like it's, you know, which is, given the scale that Mattel could bring to this, and the fact that we're already seeing a bunch of $300 and $400 3D printers out there. The thing for me is looking at this is this is either going to bust. And especially whether or not you can print to it with things other than the ThingMaker design app, or if they enable the ThingMaker design app to do all the sorts of design things you can do with a full design app. But I look at this and I think this is either going to be amazing for 3D printing, and 3D printing is going to become incredibly common, or this is going to shove 3D printing right back into the far side of the maker garage where it's been for the past few years. So $300, not a huge, print volume, but a pretty cool concept. I'm very curious.
I love this. This is in my view, as a new parent, like the next generation Legos, right? Where, okay, yes, you got sent Legos and you can make things out of Legos. Now you can build your own Legos.
I just
specific
want to say,
sizes and shapes to build.
We're going to revisit this particular moment in the conversation next week after you've tried to print your first 3D model.
Okay, fair.
The Spectre 13.3, Sebastian wrote this up. For PCPro.com. They're claiming, and man, just stare at that picture for a second. I do not hear the siren song of ever thinner electronics, but that looks like an absolutely utterly impressive piece of engineering. 10.4 millimeters. That's as thin as a AAA battery, not using a Core M processor, not using a mobile system on a chip, a full Intel Core i5 or Core i5 mobile processor, 2.45 pounds, aluminum and carbon fiber, a recessed piston hinge, hand-polished, folds into itself to enable ultra-thin 10.4 millimeter profile.
So do you see that in the... I actually think that hinge is really interesting. If you look at the top picture, it's... I don't know how that curves back under the inside. Does it... Because it's got to be one solid piece, right? It's not going to, like, collapse a little bit or something like that, or kind of unfurl. But it looks really cool, I guess.
It is a stunning piece of A, engineering, and B, style design, period. And the fact that it's coming from HP is particularly impressive. I don't really, HP tends to... I love the logo. I love the style. I love the design. I'm very, 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 very curious to feel what the keyboard feels like, because keyboards have been problematic on... every, darn near every ultra-thin laptop has been meh as far as the keyboard goes. And I think keyboards are kind of critical when you're talking about, laptops. The Intel hyperbaric cooling system, which has been floating around for, 6 years now, 6-7 years now, But it's a very interesting concept where they're basically sucking cool air in and shoving hot air out from both sides of the design. It's amazing. Right. When you scroll down below that, you're basically looking at the bulk of the computer. The computery parts of the computer are all pretty much contained right there. And Ryan, if you look to the upper left and upper right, to the upper left and upper right of those fans, I think you're seeing some of what's going on with that hinge design, that piston hinge design.
Oh, yeah. Okay, so it's going down through the depth, to the entire depth of the system there. Yeah,
possibly. Okay. I'd be really, you know, it's an interesting looking piece of engineering. HP certainly has the wherewithal to engineer something that will not fall apart. You know, the specs are good. 8 gigabytes of RAM, which doesn't really excite me too much. I would prefer 16 gigabytes, you know, but 256 or 512 gigabyte PCI SSDs. So it'll be a little bit slower than NVMe versions. 3 USB ports, a Type-C port, 2 Thunderbolt, an audio jack, 2.45 pounds, starting at $1,170 for a 256 gigabyte Core i5 system. And again, these are nice processors, Core i5-6200U or the Core i7-6500U. No ship date announced. No Wi-Fi standards released, no information on the memory specs other than that it will be 8 gigabytes. So if you're a superpower user, this may not be the laptop for you. I want to say Gordon Ma Ung got hands-on with it over at PC World. You know, there's some more close-up pictures of there. You know, essentially what they did is they made super thin hinges and put pistons on them to apply pressure is what they're saying. It's a really good looking piece of hardware, and I'm really curious to see how it holds up in the real universe. But man, way to go, HP. You get some.
Agreed. Looks good. What do you think about the new logo or the reused logo?
I like it. It's very it's stylish. It's aggressive, I guess, is probably the word I'd use for it.
It sounds like the 980 is going to get stomped out of the lineup and get replaced by the GTX 1070 because we're looking at like $379, I think. Is that right? $379 for the GTX 1070?
$379 MSRP, and then the Founders Edition thing on that one is $449. That's June 10th, I guess, availability. Yeah. I don't have hardware in yet to do to talk about performance stuff, but they did actually, kind of surprisingly, release the final specs
right
on their website. So you have an idea of what the clock speeds are, the boost clock. The clocks are a little bit lower than the GTX 1080, but you do have a pretty significant reduction in CUDA core count, right? You're actually going from 2560 down to 1920. So that's what, a 20% drop in core count. So it'll be a significant drop.
Right.
The memory speed is less because it's GDDR5 instead of G5X.
It's less CUDA cores than a GTX 980.
right. Because GTX 980 has 2048. But it'll still be faster than 980 dramatically, right? Because it's running way higher clocks than that. And the memory performance is actually better as well. So it'll still be there. That they claimed that the 970 would be faster than the Titan X as well. Mm-hmm. Now that may be only in the VR stuff, right? Because of the things we talked about before.
Mm-hmm.
Or it may end up being just in terms of raw performance, it's kind of right there. In which case that would be super impressive. Yeah. If they can do a $379 part that is beating the 980 Ti that was, you know, $650 just a couple of weeks ago. While running at less power as well. Did they release the power on it? I don't know if they did. Maybe they didn't release typical power on it, but I'm excited for the 1070. I think a lot of people are going to be more interested in that just in terms of, you know, it's the price point more people are going to be able to
afford.
Right. And, you know, the GTX 970, despite kind of some of the setbacks it had with the whole 3.5 gigs of memory versus 4 gigs of memory thing, it was still the most popular card of its generation by like a significant margin, maybe an order of magnitude, right? So I'll be curious to see how that lines up. They're rating this one at, where is it at? 150 watt TDP, so 30 watts less than the GTX 1080. So hopefully we'll have this in soon. Obviously we'll have it before the June 10th launch. I did put out I was asking people on Twitter for this card. I usually am only doing two resolutions in terms of testing. Would you rather, I think 2560 by 1440 has to be tested.
Yes.
But would you rather, in addition to that, have 1080p or 4K? Would you rather have, this is what the vast majority of monitors still are, is 1080p. Or would you rather have 4K both for a monitor you might want in the future or kind of a surrogate for high resolution VR performance, et cetera? And it's been interesting to kind of see feedback on that. Some people obviously getting greedy and going, well, obviously we want all of the benchmark.
I was
going to
say, I can't imagine anybody saying anything other than I want all of them, because I want to see if there's any, reasonable frame rate increase over the existing 1080p cards, which at some level doesn't matter unless you're a psychotic Twitch gamer. It's 4K monitors seem so far out for most people still, even for gaming, but... I mean, has there been, outside of the ballast of humanity, probably myself included, that wants 1080 and 4K, has there been any sort of, push in any particular direction?
Not really. I kind of expected the immediate response to be it should be 1080p, should be the other resolution, but it seems to have been kind of mixed 50-50 so far. I'm going to have to go back and look through all of this after the fact. In my mind, I kind of look at it as, I hate saying it, but 1080p is a solved problem, right? That's kind of what my mentality is because of all the hardware I see. Now, at some point, as you decrease the cost of video cards, if you get down to a $150 video card or even a $199 video card, that's probably not true. You can still see improvements in that price. But at $379, I feel like maybe I just need to do all three and kind of just say, look, 1080p is a solved problem here, right? And kind of say that it's this will solve all your problems, but so will the 390X and so will the GTX 980 or the 970 for that matter, right? But hopefully I get the card in with enough time to make those competent decisions and statements, if nothing else.
Or at least make them with confidence.
Yeah, exactly.
Ready to answer a question, Robert? Are you braced for impact, sir?
Yes, I'm braced. Well braced. Bring it on.
At Techno Hermit tweets, are 4K TVs finally good enough for desktop computers instead of 4K monitors, color accuracy, etc.?
Maybe.
Depends on the 4K TV.
Yeah. You would... Every 4K TV can act as a 4K monitor. So by using either DVI or HDMI or DisplayPort, whatever output your computer has, if the graphics chipset supports 4K output, you can connect that to most TVs that support 4K resolution. The scaling can be done pixel to pixel, so you're not dealing with overscan or anything like that. The big things you won't be able to do really would be stuff like high dynamic range support or, wide color gamut support. If you're thinking of somehow making that your video player, your PC as your source of your HDR content, not so much. But in terms of just using it as a display, connect it. Many of these 4K TVs actually will support 1080p resolution input at 120 hertz. The bandwidth would be equivalent to doing, say, 4K at 60 hertz, or actually it'd be 4K at 30 hertz. So there is that in mind. Generally, with any TV, if you're connecting a computer to it, you want to use the TV's cinema or movie picture preset. That will enable the least amount of possible artifact or enhancement features that could interfere with the picture quality. Things like sharpening or anything else that could interfere, especially with text. If you want to read the text clearly, you want to make sure things like sharpness are turned down. Generally, that movie or cinema picture preset will just automatically take care of that for you. Now, as far as response time goes, you might find that the TV's game mode or one of the TV's presets offers a better response time for a gaming scenario. And then beyond that, I think it would really come down to just the size of the screen. If you're going to find yourself moving your head left to right just to see the entire screen in all one shot, that might not be the best scenario for you. You may not need a 40-plus-inch computer monitor. Just be aware of the ergonomics involved when you're dealing with stuff like that.
I remember playing around back in the day. We would have you know, early 480p monitors, and you would watch people because they were like 40-inch monitors. They're these big television screens, and they were great for DVDs. But if you tried to use them as a monitor, you ended up doing the sort of, you know, I'm playing tennis as I'm trying to read something. And 4K kind of eliminates that because of the pixel density on the screen. But if you, you know, at 40 inches is really big for a desktop monitor. 32 inches isn't that bad.
Get your viewing distance right and make sure that you're not physically moving your head all over the place just to do basic right. work or to perceive the content you're trying to look at. One other thing that relates to 4K TVs and PC use has to do with the color quality. Most computers, when they're connected to a regular PC monitor, will be delivering full RGB, uncompressed video, in a sense. The full signal for red, blue, and green, be it digital or analog, depending on how you have it connected. Most of the time now, it's going to be digital. Some TVs actually have a setting built in to the display where it enables what they call sometimes UHD color or just an expanded color palette. In particular, it deals with getting full color support into the monitor from the PC, and you may have to enable that. There's some really basic test patterns that you can display in a browser window or whatever, mm-hmm. just to show you if you're getting that what they call 444 color RGB from your source device, the computer, into the TV, and if it's displaying properly. Some 4K TVs, especially the older ones, were unable to do that true 444 uncompressed color information, and they would default down to something that was a little more compressed, but giving you mostly the same visual result. However, if you want that full experience, that's something else to look out for. On Samsung TVs, I see it as UHD color. On other mm-hmm. brands of TVs, it's labeled something a little bit different. But usually it's something you have to enable per port on the TV itself. So once that's done, it's kind of like set it and forget it. You don't have to worry about it too much. Other than that, also consider too, are you paying for stuff you don't need? Like, do you not need speakers in a TV? That might be another reason to go for a right. monitor.
Can you even find speakers? I mean, you know, a lot of people are doing, including myself, you've seen like a 28 or 32 inch, you know, 4K HD TV. Why? Well, I don't care because I want to put it 3 feet in front of me on a desktop. You know, is that, you know, $400 HD TV or UHD TV or 4K TV going to hang with a, you know, a $700 or $1,000, you know, well, okay, let me put it this way. It's not going to hang with a Dell UltraSharp. It's not, you know, but
probably not. And then a lot of desktop PC displays too can be pre-configured from the factory to have right. accurate color or something like that, where it's fairly well known performance right out of the box. Whereas with some TVs, you're going to have to dig into the settings. Hopefully the manufacturer right. did a good job on it. Otherwise, too, also be aware of just what desktop platform are you in. I find within Windows, I bought a smaller notebook recently that had the scaling within Windows turned up to 150% to make it usable. And what that does will then, you know, slightly soften all the icons and other things on the screen, whereas I want that 1-to-1 pixel ratio. So do yourself a favor and try to look at the native 1-to-1 resolution on any display you're going to be using and see if it's too many pixels, literally. If you set that 4K monitor, if you're delivering 4K output to it, is the desktop at 1-to-1 pixel mapping just simply too small, or is everything just too damn tiny? And will you be then forced to use some scaling to make it all usable? Otherwise, you could have saved some money and went with, say, like a 1080p version of the TV or a slightly higher but smaller resolution PC monitor, something like that. So just you kind of got to balance everything in perspective in terms of just, you know, the size of the screen versus the size of the pixels versus what it is you're feeding it and are you going to be able to work with it.
There you have it, ladies and gentlemen.
Yeah. But otherwise, there's no technical reason. Yeah. I mean, LCD TVs, regardless of the resolution, are, you know, can be used with any computer nowadays with a variety of different input types. So
just don't buy one of the 30 hertz ones if you can still find one out there.
I don't think they're around. And that's one of the tough things too. If you're trying to do 4K 60 on a PC monitor, you're likely using DisplayPort and something to keep in mind. Although I haven't messed with the latest HDMI 2.0 cards to see if now they support 4K 60 over that interface as well. You'll figure it out. At least the PC hardware is ready to go. It's just a matter of getting the right connection and finding a display you can live with.
Early this year, the chip came out, which is a Raspberry Pi competitor, a $9 pocket PC, incredibly inexpensive. Bluetooth built in, Wi-Fi built in. Unfortunately, it uses, I don't know if you can see it, there's an audio jack right there, and it used a dongle to split out composite video and left and right channels of audio, which if you happen to have an older television lying around or you still have composite inputs on your HDTV is all right. But I find SD to be a miserable experience. So one of the things I ordered in the Kickstarter project along with the Pocket Chip was the HDMI and VGA DIP, which is essentially a big old plug-in like a GPIO mount that snaps onto the $9 pocket PC and gives it, you can snap it on backwards if you're not careful, but it won't fit. But essentially now gives it either HDMI or VGA output. The downside is that the DIP adapter is $15, so your $9 PC becomes $24. And it's currently not doing audio over the HDMI port. So not the most ideal situation if you were thinking about using this for a set-top box. But if you just want to use an HDMI monitor, it is a huge improvement over the little yellow barrel jack. And this is the Pocket Chip, which I also pre-ordered during the Kickstarter. And essentially, it's a, 780 by 272 touchscreen and little steel pressable full QWERTY keyboard and controls. And comes, preloaded. And you know, one of the things that's really cool is, I don't know if you can see it, that's a big lithium-ion battery, but all of the chip PCs have all of the charging controls you need for a 3.7-volt lithium-ion battery on board. So you charge it via a micro USB port. You still have access to the USB ports. But for $49, you essentially have this crazy Linux computer that's handheld and has about 5 hours of battery life. Not a ton you can do with it right now. It's got a writing application, a very simple, synth application called Make Music Terminal. You can browse your files. You can get help. Pico 8 is kind of the big one, which is a super indie gaming platform. And it's $49, includes the $9 chip and the 3.7-volt battery. The keyboard, is a little difficult to get used to. You know, you're not going to be speed typing on it, but I've already had some friends that are Linux gurus be like, oh, I can use it for this or for this or for this. You know, me, of course, I'm already trying to figure out how to get a FLAC player onto this because, you know, what I really need is something that's like three times the size of my current portable audio player, but costs $49 because I roll that way. GPIO pins across the top if you want to attach external devices to that and sensors and stuff. I think it's cool. They're kind of whimsical. Of course, I don't have a pencil or a pen on my desk now. I do have a pencil. They have a pencil and pen stand built into it, those little holes there, nice. Which made me laugh really hard. It's fun. It's $49. Yeah. You can pre-order them. So I'm just starting to get into, punching in some stuff into this to see if I can to get an audio player into this because I want to put an audio player in everything. Getchip.com is the website. If you order now, they're shipping them in July for $49. And if you pre-order them in your Kickstarter, it should be showing up now. And the Chip $9 PCs are also currently in pre-order. They're doing another round of those. You will have to buy a power and an AV cable separately. But if you buy those now, those are shipping in July too, as they finish off the last of the Kickstarter orders. But HDMI DIP for the $9 PC. If you found the analog video output on the chip PC frustrating, get the VGA or the HDMI adapter. It'll change everything. Everything. I'm just saying. 1080p 30 hertz. So it's going to support your 1080p TV. No problem. You have the full review. We do not, however, have reviews, or you do not have review units of the RX 470 yet.
No, or 460 for that matter. I don't even...
Or pricing for the 470.
Yeah, I'm going to be honest with you. I didn't really pay much attention to what the schedules were for those products because I didn't get them, and I was kind of slammed with the testing of the one product I did get. So, were there other reviews posted?
No. As far as I know, there are no 470s anywhere. in review.
All right, so I didn't miss something dramatic.
No, that's not what I'm saying. I'm saying, like, you know, they talked a bunch about the 480. Then AMD talked a bunch about the 470 and how the 470 was going to be VR ready, which basically makes it a 970, which is supposed to sell. Well, the 970 still selling for almost 150 to 180 more than what the 470 should be selling for. But let us talk about the 480, which is already sold out, but is a wonderful alternative should it come back in stock at its MSRP. Mm-hmm. For at this point, I'm going to say the 970 and bordering on the 980. Is that aggressive?
That is aggressive. I would say this is much closer to 970 than 980. Okay. In terms of performance, it is essentially equivalent to the Radeon R9 390 in terms of performance, and it ranges from being like 10% slower than the 970 in Grand Theft Auto 5 to being 40% faster in one case, which I think is the DX12 implementation of Hitman. So there's a pretty wide variance there. It's an impressive card. So we knew a little bit about specs. You can see on the specs table on the first page of our review. The interesting thing that we didn't know about how Polaris works and how AMD is kind of pushing this stuff is on the clock speeds. If you see there, since the introduction of GPU Boost way, way back in the day, the GTX 680 from NVIDIA, the idea of a single clock speed rating for graphics cards started to become less meaningful because they had a base clock and they had a boost clock. AMD with Polaris now has true adaptive clocking built into their architecture. So they too as well have two clocks and they call them base and boost as well. But they're actually they have different meanings, of course, because you don't want to make things simplified. The base, what AMD calls the base clock speed, which is listed on that table as a 1,120 megahertz, is the typical clock speed that you will see in a variety of games, in a variety of resolutions, in a variety of synthetic tests, right? This is kind of what they have tested and analyzed to be the typical clock speed for that particular GPU. And then they list a boost clock, which is not on that table, but it's 1266. And that is actually the maximum clock speed you will see at the highest voltage state if in a perfect scenario where the GPU is running very cool, the case is running very cool. And, you know, I would say in general, it's probably not, you're never going to hit 1266 with a reference cooler. But when we get some aftermarket coolers, you may see some of that being the case. There's 4 gig and 8 gig variants that have slightly different memory speeds, 150 watt TDP, and $199 price tag for the 4 gig variant and $239 for the 8 gig variant. So specification wise, it's a pretty impressive product for the price point. And you know, competing wise with the R9 390 and the GTX 270. Now, obviously, prices on the GTX 970 have come down a lot just because of the Pascal launch and then all the run up to this release of AMD's Polaris architecture. So at the time they announced the RX 480, the GTX 970 was still $320 or $330, I think.
At least.
So this was a $120 advantage in terms of its performance per dollar, right?
Now it's since nearly then, a $60 advantage.
yeah. Things have gone down. We knew this would be the case. NVIDIA's not dumb. And they're also, you know, NVIDIA's kind of waiting. They want to get through stock on a bunch of stuff because they have, you know, their next generation parts to think about as well. So on the last page there, we do have like pricing performance per dollar comparisons in a graph format, if you like to kind of try to see everything all at once. And you can see there's actually some actually go down to the second graph on that page, because in our comparisons, we included the R9 380 and the GTX 960. But they're so far out of class in terms of performance that including them in that data kind of skews it quite a bit, I would say. But if you look there, you get an idea of the blue bar on the left of each set is the new RX 480. Then you have the R9 390 in the orange and the GTX 970 in yellow. And clearly, even with the price reductions on the GTX 970, the RX 480 is the better value in terms of performance per dollar than any of those cards. And that's what they were going for. That's their goal. Their goal is to gain market share. Their goal is to get these cards into people's hands. And that's the way you do it, right? You do it in performance per dollar. That's what people really pay attention to in regards to new product launches like this.
It's impressive. I mean, I 3 months ago, I don't see you and I having a conversation that ever leads to us like, well, you know, I bet this summer AMD is going to drop something. It's going to completely blow the 970 out of the water for over $120 less when it ships. at this point, you know, you could buy a 970, but I think it makes a lot more sense to either wait for a 1070 or to after the prices have dropped down, or to wait for an RX 480 after the prices have dropped down. And what's really frustrating, above and beyond the fact that, okay, so the 1080, the 480 is now well over MSRP. I want to say 70, 40, it's close to $110 over MSRP. If you're up on Amazon.com, the GTX 1080 and 1070 are still ridiculously expensive. The Founders Edition, and I'm not a particular, at this point, I find the Founders Edition really irritating. Like, let's do an early Founders Edition release so you can pay an extra $100 because we like money. The businessman part of me is like, yeah, didn't even have to paint it pink or put a decal or a game in the box. My crankiness about the Founders Edition of the 1080 and 1070 aside, a GTX 1080 is selling for upwards of $800 now, which puts it almost $400 over MSRP. And now, I go to PC Per this morning and, I'm catching up on things. And Sebastian's got a write-up that we have a leak of a GTX 1060, which may or may not be the more direct competitor for the RX 480. And we'll certainly probably stick a fork in the GTX 970. And then as if that's not enough, we turn around. Sebastian also has a post of this giant collection of AMD's current We're in the Game promotion, which apparently gives us a sneak peek at the RX 490 graphics card, at least in name, and Bristol Ridge APUs. So now we've got something that may be pushing towards the 980 level of performance from AMD, presumably at a competitive price point. And remember how we told you there's no new GPU or CPUs coming till next year? Well, technically there is, but there are some APUs coming out. In the Bristol Ridge lineup, which is, gee whiz.
And it's clearly a busy summer.
It's for
graphics, right? I mean,
it's going to be awesome once the supply is there. But right now, it sucks buying a GPU. If you're HTC Vive or you're buying an HTC Vive or an Oculus Rift or you're upgrading your monitor, this sucks. Like, you know, I'm looking over here, you know, it's like, oh, there's a 950 I just bought like 6 weeks ago. Great. I particularly need that much more than the 950 for the 1080p monitor that's attached to, but you know, for that money, like, you know, it's you know, I'm frustrated because I look at this and I'm like, okay, or maybe I should be excited because, you know, there pretty much are no serious gaming CPUs or for that matter, work CPUs, desktop CPUs coming out until CES 2017, pretty much the earliest, unless somebody blows a gasket at Intel, which I really don't see happening, means if you want to build a VR rig, if you want to build a gaming machine, if you want to build anything that requires 3D graphics, just sit tight and wait for the prices on these GPUs to settle.
NVIDIA is, they're going to talk about, they announced today, actually, their competitor to the RX 480, the GeForce GTX 1060. Now, there aren't reviews out today. This is just kind of just like a preview announcement, a generalized collection of specifications and information.
Yeah.
It looks like that. It looks very similar to other cards. It's built a little bit cheaper, more plastic, less metal. There's not a window there. It's actually like a painted black section in the middle. It looks fine. This is the Founders Edition, obviously.
They're doing a Founders Edition again.
Well, they're doing a Founders Edition limited. The other Founders Editions were not limited.
Okay.
Meaning that they were going to exist for the entire life of the product. This one is limited, meaning that it's probably only going to be at launch. July 19th is when the cards will be available. Partner cards will be available on July 19th as well, I'm told. Price for the partner cards will start at $249. The Founders Edition is $299. That's a $50 difference. That's a pretty big delta for a $250 video card. So, you know, that makes it. Also, we should point out, like, it's so limited that the Founders Edition is only going to be sold on NVIDIA.com, not anywhere else, right? So it's not going to be like an EVGA or an ASUS Founders Edition or whatever. So.
But the partner cards are expected to be like around 200?
250. Or $299 like, for Founders, $250 for partner cards.
I was kind of thinking it'd be like $200, $250.
Well, keep in mind that this card is $239 with 8 gigs of memory.
Sure.
The specs on the GTX 1060 are 6 gigs of memory running at 8 gigabytes per sec or 8 gigabits per second. It has, in terms of core count, it is exactly half of the core count of a GTX 1080. So you got 1280 cores.
Okay.
Base clock of 1506, boost clock of 1700 megahertz.
So then, like, how should that perform, at least on paper, compared to a 480?
So NVIDIA says that it is 15% faster than an RX 480.
Okay.
And 70% more power efficient, right?
But, yeah, it is more than 15% higher cost. Kind of. No, it's not.
No,
not
for, $10 more in theory. Right.
Yeah.
If availability and pricing.
If you got the non-Founders edition, you've got to add, you know, a partner card or something like that.
I'm just going with the lowest cost for both.
Okay.
You know, it's 100. It's not here. It's 120. I could have brought it over. It's 120 watt TDP instead of 150 watt TDP. Yeah, it also only has one 6-pin power connector. So we'll have to measure it through our same process to see. It
should be okay.
And I would imagine
we'll probably draw more from the 6-pin and stuff. Does that other VR works, whatever stuff apply to this? It's the same architecture, right?
Yeah, so it's Pascal. It's a new chip. It's GP106 instead of GP104. So it's actually a new die. It's a smaller chip. There were rumors, and I actually thought it was going to be true that this card was going to be using another cut down version of GP104, but that clearly wasn't the case.
But will it be able to do all those VR things that haven't necessarily been rolled out?
Yes, simultaneous multi projection. Yeah, that's still a part of it. Yeah, VR single pass shading.
Okay.
All that is in there.
I mean, that potentially gives it even more of an edge down the line, but it has to be stuff that comes out for VR.
Now, we haven't done our testing on it yet because I didn't get a driver until today, but you know, the 15% faster. I have to assume that means in just normal games.
Stuff. Yeah.
And in VR, they would use different quotes, higher quotes, right? Yeah. Because what they compare the new GTX 1060 to in their own family is a GTX 980. They say you're getting the performance of the GTX 980 and the GTX 1060. So the GTX 980 launched at $499, I think.
Okay.
And this is launching at $249.
Not bad.
That's not bad. I mean, it's been what? 2 years, a year and a half, you know. So, I mean, there's an improvement. And there's already people online complaining that the GTX 960 launched at $199. So, this is actually a price increase from generation to generation, which, sure, whatever. We'll be curious to see if the 15% holds up against the RX 480.
Yep.
If it does, and there's availability, which is another big caveat.
Sure.
That's a big hit to the RX 480.
850 Evo, 4 terabyte, 2.5 inch SATA SSD review. Speedy Behemoth, which sounds like the best code name ever, or a really, really obscure X-Man or woman. Wow. So 48 layer VNAND, of course, 48 layer VNAND is performing at 32 layer VNAND levels, which is a good thing. This thing is huge. This is a 4 terabyte SSD. HDTAC transfer speeds are pretty much online with everything else in the Evo and the Pro lineup. They're pretty much maxed out at this point. 476.9 reads, 458.3 on writes, which is like a shade behind the 850 Evo 2 terabytes. But I think if you hiccup, you'll probably notice more of a difference between those two at 458.3 and 459.8 on write speeds. Again, just as fast. Pretty much everything looks like it's saturated across all the Samsungs. The MX300, that Crucial is a little bit behind there. File copy tests look good. How did the latency tests look?
Latency tests look good. I mean, there's really not much changed from the 500 gigabyte drive or whatever to this 4 terabyte drive. It kind of didn't perform better, didn't perform worse. It was just kind of right in line with expectations. There was an interesting thing on that page. Actually, if you look at that right there, this is not, it's not specific to this drive, but it was a new testing methodology that we're working on that Alan's been putting together. If you scroll down to the that image right there that you're looking at is what it looks like when a say you have a downloading application in the background like BitTorrent or something like that, and you're downloading at about 30 megabytes per second continuous according to the application. That's kind of what your traffic looks like. You see how there's like little peaks and valleys. The application is basically caching data and kind of writing it to your drive in bursts. And we often get asked for storage performance like for real world scenarios. So if you go to, scroll down to the second graph there, or the second image there, what you'll see is a look at two different drives, OCZ Trion on the left, Samsung 850 Evo on the right. And what this new testing methodology does is we are able to simulate a constant 30 megabytes per second of writes in the background. And then the higher spikes that we're simulating there are 200 megabytes of reads all at once, as if you were starting up Photoshop or opening up a Chrome browser that had a bunch of tabs in it or something like that, right? And so what we're measuring now is kind of like the impact of background activity on kind of other types of activity. On the right, you see the 850 Evo 4 terabyte drive that's focus of this review kind of has the higher spikes are those 200 meg reads. It's consistent. On the left, the OCZ Trion, it's almost consistent, but you have two instances where it kind of spikes up to 100%. And these are just some properties of the different caching mechanisms that these drives are using, et cetera. So we're diving more into that. So what happens is what's interesting is that if you scroll down to the graph that Alan put together, you'll see kind of active speed during bursts, right? So both in reads and writes, the blue bars being reads and the orange bars being writes. Obviously, higher is still better. But this is kind of what your effective megabyte per second performance throughput would be on those reads and on those writes when the drive was doing them. Obviously, since your write shows, you know, the top line shows we're writing at 198 megs per second. But if we're only actually writing 30 megabytes per second from, you know, our torrent, what that's measuring is essentially the application caches it in RAM and then bursts it all to the drive in small doses, right? And so those small doses are essentially running at the 198 megs per second. And so you can see SATA drives tend to be fairly consistent, fairly regular, but you know, you look at like something like the MX300, which is a new drive that we actually had pretty good performance results with our previous testing, but it shows there that it's actually quite a bit lower than the Evo drives than the SX930, which I think is I can't remember whose brand that is now actually. But you can tell that the MX300 is lower. The writes are actually affecting the read speed of it dramatically. And then you can go down and look at the PCIe NVMe drives, the 950 Pro at the bottom, the Intel SSD 750, and see that they're way ahead of those writes. And then the next graph down, sorry to onslaught you with new data here, shows like the read time, right? So this is for the total 10 iterations of 200 megs apiece, two gigs of data, while a background write is going. And this is maybe more indicative of, say, you were loading up Doom and you were loading up your save game. It's probably going to read 2 gigabytes of textures and data into your system and into the graphics card, right? So this is indicative of that, right? And this is based in time where lower is better. Right. And you can see the Evo 4 terabyte, 4.25 seconds, whereas that MX300 is actually up to 7.5 seconds or so. So you can actually see what the potential real world difference is in the performance of these drives. And then people often ask us, hey, is an NVMe drive actually faster in real world usage? And we look at that and you see that it would be able to load that level of Doom in 1.75 seconds as opposed to 4.5 seconds or so for a traditional SATA SSD. So there are gains to be found there. And what's really cool is this testing method that we're working on will allow us to simulate a whole bunch of different things based on workloads. So nothing specific about the 850 Evo 4 terabyte here stands out in that testing, but it was kind of just the first place we used it. So we wanted to mention that at least. Did you see the price of this drive, by the way?
The last I looked at it, it was $1,600.
It's 15. Well, the MSRP is $1,500.
Right. It's dangerously close to your goal of like sub 25 cents a gigabyte.
I mean, it's
looking at 10 cents a gigabyte.
I wanted 10 cents a gigabyte. My problem with this is that the 4 terabyte drive is not any less in cost per gigabyte than like the 500 gigabyte drive, which I don't really understand. Mm-hmm. You would think as the drives get bigger that the cost efficiency would spike to in a way that these would actually come down in price. But that's apparently not the case, at least not initially. I don't think this drive actually goes on sale until a little bit later this month. But
at this point they're taking pre-orders. I'll be curious to see what it sells for. And it might also, this also might mean that effectively all of the cost in, you know, it costs next to nothing to assemble and package an SSD, mm-hmm. and that all of the cost is tied up in the physical memory.
Maybe, I guess. Yeah.
I don't know. I'm still struck by, like, you know, Alan's finally given us a set of tests where you can justify the additional expense of a 950 Pro or one of Intel's 750s.
Just what you and your wife wanted to hear, right?
Yeah, just what my wife wanted to hear.
Yeah.
Honey, I need a 950 Pro. I'll be more efficient. I'll be able to get home from the office earlier.
Ryan, can I come live in your house? I could be your manny.
That's fine. You just gotta move to Kentucky.
Let's talk about something I don't think either one of us was expecting. Maybe you were expecting. You may be the only person who was expecting it. 3,584 CUDA cores of Lust, ladies and gentlemen. GP102-based Titan X. This is a beast. If you are the person that is using the app that uses all the CUDA cores and your business depends on you doing more stuff faster, this is the GPU you've been dreaming of. I am shocked, actually, maybe that's the word I'm looking for here, that it's a mere $1,200, given that the Titan X with the GM200 GPU and 3,072 cores is $1,000. 16-nanometer process, 11 billion transistors. I want to say that one more time. 11 billion transistors, peak compute of 11 teraflops. That is a huge bump up from the Titan X, which is 6.14 teraflops. It is a significant jump up from the GTX 1080, which is running 8.2 teraflops for half the price.
Sure. Yeah,
and 1,000 less CUDA cores. 1,417 megahertz clock speed, 224 texture units, 12 gigabytes of memory. This card is a beast. Like 480 gigabytes per second of memory bandwidth. And yes, kids, in case you were looking for the excuse to buy that 1,000-watt power supply you've just been avoiding for oh so long, like the GTX 1080. Oh, wait, like the GTX 980 Ti, it's running a 250-watt TDP. Man.
Yeah.
This is a serious card.
It is. It's a really interesting card in a whole lot of unique ways, right? Both in terms of its timing of release, the way it was done. Jensen, the CEO of NVIDIA, just kind of showed up at an AI meetup at Stanford, right? Like, uh-huh. It wasn't at an NVIDIA event or anything like that. He just showed up in his leather jacket and announced it. And then NVIDIA's, you know, PR team sent out emails to the media and whatnot. It's an interesting card for a couple of other reasons too, right? Like, so it's a new GPU. It's GP102. It is a different chip than we've seen before in any other product. It's not the same chip that the GTX 1080 is based on. It's not the same chip that we saw announced way back in May, maybe before that, where they announced the GP100 inside the P100 processor, which is one that had HBM2 in it. This is different than that even, right? Because this is, what's interesting is that it's nearly the same amount of CUDA cores as that enormous kind of, you know, enterprise only product. I think that one had 3,840. This has 3,584, but those use HBM2. This uses GDDR5X memory. So a new memory interface, but very much similar, you know, very similar to what we have in other graphics cards today. You know, the 1080 uses GDDR5X already as well. It's still, you know, it's got 12 gigs of memory. It's running at the same 10 gigahertz clock speed. You do get 480 gigabytes of total memory bandwidth, gigabytes per second, which is actually pretty close to the memory throughput you got on the R9 Fury X, which was the first generation HBM part. It was rated at 512 gigabytes per second. So this card is getting close to that with, you know, modified existing technology, more or less. The 250 TDP is kind of in line with other high-end parts, like the previous Titan X. Even the naming of it is kind of odd, right? It's just called Titan X, which was already a product. The Titan X was released as a Maxwell part based on GM200, that GPU. And now this Titan X is a completely new architecture, a completely new process. Everything about it is new except the name, which, you know, why didn't they go with Titan P or Titan XP or something else to kind of differentiate it rather than going the Apple route of the new iPad, the new Titan X? It's a little bit odd there. The $1,200 price tag is good and bad, right? There's a strong argument to be made that NVIDIA, with the Pascal generation and kind of with the Maxwell generation, has kind of been creeping up on prices across the board. The previous Titan X launched at $999. This one is launching at $1,200. Even though the GPU itself, like the physical die space of GP102 compared to the old GPU, GM200, is smaller. So even though it's a smaller die, you're getting more. They're charging you more. Now there are issues. It could be yields that are there. Just, you know, supply and demand issues are there. I think they've got very intelligent people at NVIDIA that are in the sales and marketing teams, and they know what they can sell it for, and they're going to price it accordingly. It's also interesting, it's only going to be sold through NVIDIA.com starting August 2nd, actually, so really soon. But it's not going to be sold through partners. It's as far as I know, only going to be sold through NVIDIA.com. And I don't know if that was maybe something of NVIDIA knowing it was going to be a niche part and their partners didn't want to carry it, or you know, they want to be able to control pricing more concretely than they've been able to do. As we do every week on the show, we check in on nowinstock.net and see what cards are available, and they're still hard to come by. So you would assume if they're only going to be sold through NVIDIA, like, you're not going to see the price increases that you see at Newegg or Amazon through third-party resellers and whatnot. Now, availability may be difficult to get a hold of, obviously, but at least pricing might be controlled somewhat. It's a really beast of a card. Now, I will say that NVIDIA has told me that they're not sampling this as a gaming card. They're going to focus on the deep learning, GPU compute, AI side of things initially. So I would expect to see some performance results from that come out on August 2nd or 3rd. But as far as I know, all I can say is I know they're not sending me one yet. And I'm not going to spend $1,200 to buy one necessarily. If they'll send one out a little bit later. The Titan brand is always in this weird spot where they call it a gaming card. They also call it a deep, like a GPU compute card. But they know that it's going to lean more towards the compute side, right? Because what we have to assume now that we know this GPU exists, and that the GTX 1080 exists, that somewhere in between will fall the GTX 1080 Ti, right? Or whatever they decide to call that product. How they differentiate it from Titan X, I don't really know yet. You know, because one of the ways they differentiated before was through memory. You can't really do that here because the 1080 already has 8 gigs. So you have to have 12 gigs on the 1080 Ti just because of the way the memory bus is configured. So it would just have to be somewhere performance-wise between a Titan X and a GTX 1080. And where would that fall in price? Would that be $899, $999? It wouldn't be $799, right? Because their Founders Edition cards are $699 already, the 1080. So you're talking at least a $200 to $300 price jump over where 1080 is.
Razer just dropped their new 17-inch gaming laptop, which is yet another moonshot over the top bit of craziness. Although for a incredibly expensive top of the line laptop, it's relatively affordable, a mere $3,700 with a 4K touchscreen, Thunderbolt 3, GeForce GTX 1080 graphics, and, says The Verge, a whole lot more. Core i7-6700 HQ processor, GTX 1080 GPU, the desktop card, not a mobile version, writes Vlad over at The Verge. PCIe M.2 SSD storage, anywhere from 512 to 2 terabytes. So the 32 gigabytes of DDR4 RAM, which is a ridiculous amount of memory for a gaming machine. 17.3 inch 4K panel with G-Sync support and multi-touch. It's pretty fantastic stuff. So, if you want something completely over the top and you've got $3,700 and you're not willing to wait for one of the bespoke mobile gaming machines that we saw earlier this summer, something worth considering. So
they make really, really, I'll be honest, I've never had any experience with Razer laptops, but they look great. And the times I've seen and the people that have had them tend to have pretty good experiences. I don't know about the long-term build quality necessarily, but in terms of like looks and sexiness for a gaming PC, they're at the top for sure.
And I'm up at RazerZone.com. We have the reveal trailer. Can we order it yet? Oh, I also forgot. It's an ultra-low profile mechanical keyboard.
That sounds fishy to me.
Well,
I'll think about it. Ultra-low profile mechanical sounds to me like scissors.
This revolutionary technology with slim chiclet keycaps raises the bar for ultra-mobile keyboards. Featuring anti-ghosting capabilities, optimized reset points, and an actuation force of 65 grams. Huh. It's got like a little button switch inside of what looks a lot like a traditional plastic scissor switch.
Yeah. So, right? Yeah,
but it's a scissor switch, but instead of having a membrane key underneath it, it has a little tiny switch. If you go to, razorzone.com/gaming-systems/razor-blade-pro,
I think you can see a teardown of it.
And, of course, it's got Razer Chroma lighting with 16.8 million colors, individually backlit keys.
RGB, dogs.
Well, if you're going to spend $3,700, it better look bright and shiny.
RGB. RGB.
For the win. RGB FTW. LOL. So you've been testing one of the most outrageous earbud sets on the planet.
They're kind of pricey. I had the cord.
The KSE 1500 electrostatic earphone system by the people at Shure.
It's pretty crazy. So you
electrostatics don't travel well because they require very high voltage to run.
Yes. So you need a special amp just to drive them. Just drive these tiny earbuds. Camera doesn't want to focus, but you get the point. Pretty dang small.
It's an amp, it's a DAC, and it's basically punching 250 volts in your ears, if memory serves.
It's definitely a higher voltage because it's electrostatics. Basically, it acts like a high voltage capacitor. Mm-hmm. Except part of the capacitor is actually a moving part.
Right.
And the advantage is that you're talking a super, super thin element, the actual thing that does the moving, is just a very thin sheet, and a diaphragm there on that in that photo, and it's just, or in that video, and these things sound incredibly transparent. It's basically that's the best word I can use for them. It's just like you're not listening to speakers. You're just this is one of the few things where if I pull up some I have a couple of recordings that are like, symphony orchestra stuff that's recorded in particular halls where I've actually listened to an orchestra play, like in person. And these are just a set of earbuds that if you're just listening to that content and you know you put these things on, you close your eyes, you're there. I mean, there's really just, you're picking out every little detail, you know, every things, the way things are bouncing off walls that you mm-hmm. were able to, you know, understand from having been there in person. It's one of those things where it's so dang accurate.
Yeah, there's a lot of resolution, a lot of detail. Like a planar magnetic, they have, planar magnetic, they use metal conductors on the surface of the diaphragm to move the diaphragm and create the waves of air that go into your ear. With electrostatics, the diaphragm itself is electrically charged material. And that's part of where they get an incredible level of neutrality. Like $3,000 sounds pretty crazy for a set of earbuds, and it is. Yes. But compared to a set of Stax headphones, they've kind of been the flagship in electrostatics. It starts looking kind of reasonably priced because I think Stax are still selling for like $6,000 a pair.
Yeah.
And it's I will say
there are kind of limits. Like the ultimate volume you can reach with these is not as high as with standard earbuds. Right. Most standard earbuds. They do start to distort. The distortion is not necessarily a result of like because of the driver. It's just because you can only generate so much of a static charge. The system was only designed to go so high. You still get to very, very reasonably loud volumes, listening volumes, but just not as loud as you can get some of the other things. So if you're a real, real metalhead kind of guy, you really want to crank everything. These may not be for you. I will say this though, bass response surprisingly good for something that's an electrostatic driver. Historically, electrostatic drivers have been weak in that area. There's plenty of like really, really high-end home stereos that have used electrostatic drivers where they still had to have an actual like physical subwoofer, like a standard subwoofer as part of the kit. Right. These are doing all that with just one driver in each ear. It's just one super, super sensitive, wafer thin, not even wafer thin.
This
is, there's only so many words I can use to describe these things. It's one of those things you really just have to have sat down and listened to them in a quiet room and had really good content to listen to. That's the other key. I am able to almost instantly pick out the difference between any form of like even kind of higher bitrate MP3 compression versus lossless with these things. It's one of those things where the higher the quality of the the device you're using to listen to that audio stream, the better you can pick out if you're able to perceive those differences. I have to like willfully try to not be listening for MP3 artifacts with these things in order to enjoy MP3 music. So it's probably just the benchmark of like studio monitors, really. Like you're just, if you're developing music or anything like that, you're working on stuff, you want to hear exactly what that stuff's going to sound like in an ideal scenario. That's it. That's the way to listen to them.
It is one interpretation, and we will get into that conversation at another date. Because everybody's eardrums are different. Everybody's ear canals are different, and that radically changes the way you hear things. And
that's true. Yeah,
it's good stuff, though. I thought it was funny because you went back to your 846s and you were like, "Ugh."
Yeah,
and those are pretty nice earbuds.
Yeah, it turned out I had to change the tuning on my 846s because there were aspects of that when I was sitting down and I gathered a whole bunch of like really high end kind of HD tracks, mm-hmm. Other recordings to just sit down and do the like kind of A/B listening back and forth, and then because I had that really high quality source material to listen to, that's when I would go back to the 846s and be like, something's wrong here. Like these things should be doing better. Then, because those are $1,000 set of earbuds. They should at least be $1,000 worth of audio quality. And turned out I had to do some tweaks to actually dial them in a little bit better. But I'm glad that, you know, the newer set, the Electrostatic, kind of forced me to do that tuning of the other set. So in the end, it was a win-win.
It's just a 15-meter die handmade CPU.
This is really, yes.
Do we need to slap a bird on this?
Probably. So this is a project built by just a computer science geek called the Mega Processor. It is a working CPU blown up in size to allow you to walk in to the processor and watch how data is physically processed by your own eyes. So there's a bunch of LEDs that show what is happening at each portion of the processor. If you click on the picture, you get a slightly bigger version of it, and you can see that each kind of section has its own label, right? So you can see the second from the right is the ALU. That's the arithmetic logic unit. So that's like the actual math takes place. You have general purpose registers on the right hand side, and to the left of it, you have special purpose registers. You have your input and output, like instruction decode, to the left of it. And then if you go all the way to the left, the one that just looks like a mash of green is the memory. That's the CPU's cache, if you will, the memory system that it uses to store data, how you load programs into it. And so you can actually watch a program that is built for this run through. And it was built with like wire and ribbon cables and all by hand.
The backstory on this is crazy because the guy that built this, right, 42,000 transistors, weighs half a ton, kind of fits in a truck. James Newman says there was a conversation at work about that time when we were talking about debugging something, and someone remarked it would be easier if we had an LED on a signal. And he wanted to learn about transistors, and quote, things got out of hand. 42,000 hand-soldered transistors later. His ultimate goal, other than the pure satisfaction of building the thing and getting it running, as the Register reported in June, was to show the public how computers work by blowing the CPU up to a human viewable scale. Crazy. 42,300 transistors, 10,548 LEDs, all hand soldered into place. And the LEDs visually trace the path of data through the giant processor. This is so cool.
It's really, really cool. It's apparently now at the Center for Computing History in Cambridge. And I would love to go and see it, right? And this is the kind of thing that if you're a computer science or an electrical engineering major, like watching how this occurs is like super educational. It's not just neat. Like this is how they would teach you how to do these types of things. Mm-hmm. It's pretty impressive. Runs at 25 kilohertz. 25 kilohertz. So there you go.
I just think this is, charming and delightful.